This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Michael Daventry, and coming up on this program... It was a decade ago this week that the Israeli corporal Gilad Shalit was released by Hamas after 5 years in captivity. We look back on a story that gripped Israel and a lot of the world at the time and find out what happened next. This Saturday marks the 10th anniversary of Gilad Shalit's release. The corporal was captured by Hamas on the 25th of June 2006 during a cross-border raid into Israel on an IDF post. Two Israeli soldiers were killed and two others wounded in the attack. Shalit sustained a broken hand and a wounded shoulder. He was taken through a tunnel into Gaza. He ended up staying there for 5 years. This episode of the Jewish News Podcast will feature excerpts of a longer conversation that I had this week with Gershon Baskin, a long-standing Israeli activist, campaigner and columnist who spent many years trying to improve relations between Israelis and Palestinians. In a moment, we'll hear some of the things Baskin tried to do to secure Gilad Shalit's release. But before that, he explained to me why this particular hostage incident had become so personal to him.
I've been involved in bridging Israeli-Palestinian relations for more than 40 years. At that point, when Gilad Shalit was first abducted, I'd been engaged with Palestinians for about 25 years. In September of 2005, I was attending a conference that we helped to organize on the future of Jerusalem, which is taking place in Switzerland with Israelis and Palestinians and international experts on Jerusalem. And I got a phone call from my wife back in Jerusalem who told me that one of her first cousins had gone missing. My wife was an Iraqi Jew. She has a very large family, lots of cousins. This is a cousin that we knew quite well. He had traveled with us in a car from a family wedding a few weeks before that. His name was Sasson Nouriel. The information that they knew was that he had gone off to Ramallah to see a factory that had closed down so that he could buy the machinery for his own factory at a candy factory outside of Jerusalem. Sasson went missing. And they asked me, the family asked me to use my contacts with the Palestinians to see if anyone knew anything. I called back home to my Palestinian colleague that I was working with at the time, who went off to Ramallah and asked around the security forces there. No one knew anything. A few days later, Hamas released a video of my wife's cousin who had been tortured. He was handcuffed and he was blindfolded. And he read out a statement in Arabic. He spoke fluent Arabic, demanding that Israel release Palestinian prisoners in exchange for his life. And a few days later, his body was found on the side of a road in the West Bank. He had been murdered with a butcher's knife. It was very, very brutal. We attended his funeral along with about 1,000 Israelis. And I stood over his grave and feeling so horrible because they asked me to help and I couldn't do anything. And I swore to myself that evening, late at night, over his grave, that if anyone ever came to me asking for help of that kind again, I would do everything humanly possible. Well, that was the motivation that was in the back of my mind throughout the 5 years and 4 months that Gilad Shalit was in captivity.
It was an incident that Baskin says drove him to do everything he could to help when another Israeli, Gilad Shalit, was taken hostage.
6 days after he was abducted, I got a phone call from this professor from Gaza, Professor Mohammed Migdad, who said, Gershon, we have to do something. We're being bombed. We have no water, we have no electricity. I said, what can we do, Mohammed? He said, let's try to open up a channel of communication between the two sides. He drove to the prime minister's office, the prime minister of Hamas in Gaza, Ismail Haniya. And about half an hour later, I got a phone call from the director general of that office who told me that someone else would be calling me. And a little while later, Dr. Ghazi Hamad called me. He was the spokesperson of the Hamas government and a special advisor to Prime Minister Ismail Haniya. And two things very surprising happened in that phone call, for me at least. Ghazi Hamad spoke to me in Hebrew, and the spokesperson of the Hamas government. And I said to him, you know, you can speak to me in Arabic or you can speak to me in English. And he said to me, I enjoy speaking Hebrew. He had learned Hebrew in Israeli prison, where he had been in prison for 7 years, and he liked to practice his Hebrew. The next thing he said to me really touched me, because he said, let's try to open up a conversation between the soldier's father and one of the Hamas leaders. Now, I'm standing there in my kitchen talking to him on the phone, looking at my two boys who are in the kitchen who are just under the age of being drafted into the Israeli army. And I couldn't think of a more humane gesture to speak to the soldier's father. I said I would try to find him. And it took me a few hours to get the phone number of the Shalit family and to speak to Noam and Aviva Shalit, Gilad's parents, and suggested to them that they have this conversation. And they, of course, agreed immediately, saying, we want to know what happened to our son. We want to know if he's alive. We want to know what his situation is, what they want to release him. So that conversation took place later that day. And the next day, the Shalits came to Jerusalem, and I met them for the first time. And I told them at that, too, we were sitting on the grass overlooking Jerusalem on the in the Talpiot Plaza, overlooking the walls of the old city. And I said to them that I would be with them and supporting them and doing anything I could until we brought Gilad home.
And so Gershon Baskin travelled to Gaza as an Israeli citizen carrying Israeli paperwork to meet Hamas official Ghazi Hamad, in the hope of securing a letter from Gilad Shalit to prove to his parents that he was still alive.
At that meeting, I proposed to Ghazi Hamad, since we failed with the video and that Israel was not going to pay anything for information, I suggested to him that they provide a handwritten letter from Gilad Shalit and that there'd be nothing in exchange for the letter, but it would be the way for us to open negotiations. And he actually liked the idea. He told me to wait in Gaza while he tried to deliver the message. I went to a seaside restaurant and sat there for the next hours waiting for Ghazi Hamad to return. He returned after several hours and told me that the people that he transmitted the message to liked the idea of a handwritten letter very much, and I should wait. Well, I waited some more, and it began to get dark, and I decided I was not going to stay in Gaza overnight. So I went back to Jerusalem, and I had hoped that I would leave Gaza that day with a letter from Gilad Shalit. But the next day I called Ghazi Hamad, and he told me that they agreed to the letter and it's on its way. And they said it would be delivered to the office of the Egyptian representative in Gaza. So I waited a day and 2 days and 3 days and a week and 2 weeks, and nothing came. And Ghazi Hamad explained to me that someone in the political level was stopping the letter. Someone was Khaled Mashal, the Hamas leader at the time, who was sitting in Qatar. So I called Noam Shalit, and we were approaching Rosh Hashanah. I think we were still near the end of Ramadan, if I remember correctly. And I suggested to Noam Shalit that he write a letter to Khaled Mashal, father to father. And not a political level, but just a father. Tell me what's the situation of my son. Let me receive this letter that was on its way, we were told. We had the letter translated to Arabic. I had Khalid Mashal's email and his fax number in Syria. I even tried calling. They knew who I was and refused to talk to me. But 2 days later, I got a phone call early in the morning from Ghazi Hamad saying that the letter was delivered to the Egyptians. The next day, the letter arrived in Israel. It was verified by the Israeli security forces that this was a handwritten letter from Gilad Shalit.
So a letter was secured, and it was definitive proof that Shalit was still alive. But negotiating his release was another matter, not least because of Hamas's demand for the release of prisoners in their hundreds in exchange for Shalit. Then there was the dogged insistence of Ehud Olmert, Israel's prime minister of the time, that his government did not, in his words, negotiate with terrorists. It was to take many years and a new prime minister before there was to be progress.
In April of 2011, on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, I got a phone call. I heard in the news that Netanyahu appointed a new point person in charge of the file, a man named David Meidan. I'd never heard his name before. He was an officer in the Israeli Mossad. I started talking to Ghazi Hamad again, who at this point was now the deputy foreign minister of the Hamas government. And Ghazi was very anxious for us to be involved in a direct negotiation. I told him about David Meidan, and I was waiting for David to call me back. I suggested to Ghazi that he try to speak to Jabri and get permission from Jabri to pass messages back and forth. 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from David Meidan, and he asked me to deliver a message to Hamas. And I picked up the phone and called Ghazi and delivered the message. And within an hour, I got an answer back. And I gave the answer to David, and he was quite shocked, because from what he learned from the file was that every time they passed messages to Hamas, it would take weeks and sometimes months before they got a response. And now they got a response within an hour. So he asked me to deliver another message. And again, within an hour, I got a answer from that. And at this point, David, who had been inundated with people calling him and saying, I want to help, I can do this, I know people, like most of them were quite outrageous in their estimation of their abilities. But David at this point went to Netanyahu and said, I have a hot, direct, secret back channel, and I want permission to run it. He didn't say who it was and what was going on. He didn't give the details. Netanyahu said he'd agreed to having a direct secret back channel. You have to understand that the policy of Israel was that we have no contact with Hamas. We don't deal with Hamas directly. And here was this guy from the Mossad saying he has a direct back channel to Hamas. And Netanyahu agreed on the condition that it would remain out of the news, that no one would know about it. It would be secret. And over the next weeks and months, I was on the phone all day and all night with Razi Hamad, delivering messages back and forth, and I would deliver them forward to David Maidan. And that went on. Razi and I went through a process of negotiating a document of principles that went through seven renditions until we arrived at the breakthrough document, which was really a breakthrough because it delivered significant compromises by Hamas on their initial demands, and all kinds of other conditions that through our direct negotiation, we managed to bring down to a point that David Maidan went to Netanyahu and said, we have a breakthrough. We can arrive at agreement. I want a mandate from you to make the deal. At that point, David understood that he had to involve the Egyptians directly, and he approached the Egyptian intelligence services, and they took over those negotiations, which went into much more detail, including list of names of people to be released and the exact conditions for each one of those prisoners.
Eventually, a deal was struck, and with Shalit on the verge of being released, Gershon Baskin says the Mossad chief asked him about his intentions.
He said, what do you want? Thinking that I was asking for money or something like that. I said, I have one request. When Gilad Shalit crosses the border into Israel, I want to be there. That was the only thing I wanted. And of course, on the day that Gilad Shalit came back, David called me in the morning and told me that Netanyahu refused. I couldn't be there.
So what was it like to be kept hostage by Hamas for so long? Gilad Shalit has rarely spoken about his time in captivity publicly, so there is a lot that we still don't know about those 5 years. But Baskin has become a family friend and can explain what we do know about how Shalit coped.
We know that he was in the same place more or less most of the time, you know, about three or four different places during the 5 years and 4 months. The last house he was in, he was there for about a year and a half, living in the basement of a house. He heard family above him. He was never physically abused. Loneliness was the most difficult thing that he faced. He was in one place, the last place actually, he was in a room behind bars. He used to exercise on those bars. They sometimes ridiculed him, his captors, and called him a monkey. But he kept to a routine. He would try to wake up every day at the same time. His days and nights were kind of reversed. That's what they did to him there. But he would wake up and he would exercise and he tried to eat regularly. He tried to do mind games to keep his mind active and busy. He drew a big poster of the community that he comes from. He lives in a small community up on the northern border of Israel. And he drew every house on the map of the community and tried to write all the names of the people that he remembered who lived in that house. He did math games to keep his mind busy. There are actually two of his captors. His captors were with him the whole time also. And they were not allowed to leave, so they were captive with him. One of them spoke Arab, one of them spoke Hebrew, one of them spoke English. He had a television for about 3.5 years, and they would watch sport games together. He had a radio, and he heard the news every day, how many days he was in captivity. He heard all the efforts that were being made, the public protests that were going on in Israel, around the world, for his release. That caused him a lot of ups and downs, because every time he got optimistic that something was happening, it then crashed and nothing happened. We know that had he remained in captivity another month, he would have died from malnutrition. And that's not because he didn't have food. He did. But because of acute vitamin D deficiency, his body stopped digesting the food. And for the last about month that he was in captivity, he was vomiting all the food that he ate. When he was actually physically transferred to the Israeli side and they put him on a helicopter to take him to the Israeli side, which should have been a 10-minute helicopter ride, he actually fainted. He collapsed. They had to give him adrenaline to keep him going. And that helicopter ride lasted 45 minutes before they resuscitated him and brought him to meet his family. He had been wounded in the attack. One of the Palestinian fighters had dropped a hand grenade in the tank and it exploded. And when he came home, he had an operation that lasted for 6 or 7 hours to remove 8 pieces of shrapnel from his arm that was embedded in his bone and nerve. He had lost the use of 3 fingers in his hand because of that wound. He went through years of physical therapy afterwards to get the use of his fingers back. But he came out amazingly strong. Traveling around the world, he was invited all over the world by the Jewish communities all around the world. He traveled to thank them and to get his life back to normal. He started working for an Israeli newspaper. He registered for university and went into the BA in economics and sustainability at the Interdisciplinary College in Herzliya. Afterwards, he was hired by Bank Discount in their investment department, and that's what he's been doing over the last 6 years or so. He got married, as I said, just a couple of months ago. And he's amazingly normal and private. He's a very private individual, and he was always private. When he was asked, how did you manage to stay so strong? He said, I was always very introverted. I was never a very outgoing, extroverted person. I spent a lot of time with myself growing up. So he was used to being by himself, and that was certainly one of the things that helped him. I think he is recognized. Everyone sees him and recognizes Gilad Shalit. He's pointed out all the time. People stop him and ask him for his autograph, and a lot of people recognize him. He's also, unfortunately, been dragged into a big argument within Israeli society. At the time of the deal, 80% of Israelis supported it. 26 ministers of the Israeli government voted for it. 3 ministers voted against it. The head of the Mossad, the head of the Shin Bet, the chief of staff of the Israeli army, the chief of police, the prime minister all supported the deal. And yet today, if you go around and ask people, did you support the Shalit deal, you would probably find less than 50% of people who would admit that they supported it at the time. And it's become very controversial because Israel released 1,027 people in exchange for Gilad Shalit. More than 300 of them had been people who had killed Israelis, including 4 of the people responsible for killing my wife's cousin were released in the Shalit deal. So I know the personal pain that's involved in one of these deals. And of course, the big question was always, how many Israelis are going to be killed by saving one Israeli soldier? And the unfortunate reality is that some Israelis were killed by people who were released in the deal or people connected to people released in the deal. And then the question is, well, should we have done it? And my answer to that was that it was the only deal possible. It was the best deal possible. There were a lot of conditions undertaken within the deal to minimize the risk to it. The first Israeli was killed by one of the people released. The person who killed the Israeli was someone who wasn't even suspected by the Israeli security services as being a risk. There were high-risk people released. This guy was not one of them. We will have terrorism continue as long as we have the conflict continuing. And even perhaps beyond resolving the conflict, we will have people who will continue to use terrorism to kill Israelis because they object to Israel's right to exist. That's part of the reality. And it's not necessarily the people who released from prison are responsible for killing Israelis, because there are lots of people who were not released in the prison who killed Israelis subsequently. And we need to look at this question of the safety of Israelis living here in insecurity as connected to the reality of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and our need to address that conflict head on. And that's not going to be done until we sit down with our enemies and make sure that the worst of them are at the table talking to them. And that's my philosophy. I'm willing to talk to anyone who's willing to talk to me. And I think if we look at Northern Ireland as an example, one of the successes of the Northern Ireland process was that Senator Mitchell was stubborn enough to wait for everyone to be at the table. IRA was there, and then the real IRA was there, and they went around and brought in the people who were most opposed to the agreement and made sure that everyone was part of the deal. And that's what we're going to have to do here as well. Hamas is part of the reality of the Palestinian political culture. We're going to have to deal with them, as difficult as that is. There are political deals that can be made for ceasefires, for understandings, for development, and perhaps even for peace. That's what we need to do.
Gershon Baskin reflected movingly in our conversation about his wife's cousin who'd been taken hostage by Hamas and died, and about Gilad Shalit who'd been taken hostage by Hamas and survived. As a final question, I asked him if another Israeli is taken hostage in similar circumstances in the future, would Israeli society react in the same way as it did for Shalit?
Look, we have a different situation in real time. We have the body of two Israeli soldiers who were killed in Gaza in the summer of 2014. And there are two Israeli, and there are bodies of two soldiers being held, and the families want them back very much. And we have two Israeli civilians, an Ethiopian Israeli and a Bedouin Arab Israeli, who are both defined as being mentally ill, who crossed into Gaza on their own. The Bedouin had crossed in several times, and the third time in, the Hamas kept him. They didn't return him back. The Ethiopian Israeli, someone named Avera Mengisto, crossed in, and the Israeli army watched him cross. They could have stopped him, but they thought he was a Sudanese worker who was going back to Africa. So they let this young man cross the border into Gaza. And we're 7 years into this case right now. Hamas is demanding that Israel release prisoners, including prisoners who killed Israelis. The Israeli government refuses to release prisoners who have killed Israelis. They're willing to release prisoners. They're willing to release bodies that Israel is holding as well as bargaining cards. It's quite grotesque, if you ask me, that we're negotiating for dead bodies. But that's part of the reality. And for 7 years, there's no agreement. And the major difficulty right now is the refusal of Israel to release any Palestinian prisoners who killed Israelis. And the Hamas demand that the prisoners released include murderers of Israelis. So we're stuck, and who knows how many years this will go on. I think it's important to make a deal because we have to look at the future of Gaza. There are 2.3 million people living in Gaza in terrible poverty, and we need to work out a deal to reconstruct Gaza, to allow Gaza to live a normal life as much as possible, and to hopefully sometimes sit down with them and talk about peace. But there's so much that can be done and isn't being done in Gaza because of this prisoners issue, which is holding up everything.
Gershon Baskin. And that's it from the Jewish News Podcast this week in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to thank my guest, Gershon Baskin, my colleague, Justin Cohen, for the help producing this episode, Leo Mendel and Adam Bradley for their work in post-production, and to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way, you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast, and goodbye.